Excision number 11939, rule 8.
Reel 8. You were digging the anti-tank ditch on the Belgium frontier, Mr. Williams. What are your memories of that particular job?
It was very wet. The ground was very wet because it would be about getting on for March and so on. And we occasionally had a dusting of snow, damp snow, strange enough. Nothing of the harsh sort of winters one would have expected. And we dug this huge ditch clad in Wellingtons. We were taken up in trucks from early morning. We dug and had our rations brought out in containers. And then, as I say, the ridiculous part was we just dug an agricultural place and we didn't dig in roads. And it was big enough for a tank to fall into if the tank driver was daft enough to go into it, you know. But it struck me as particularly futile because you couldn't under any circumstances cross the Belgian frontier. Belgium was neutral, you know.
Was it not being linked by any form of concrete defence?
No. It was purely a ditch, purely an earth ditch, that stage. As I say, you couldn't go anywhere near the Belgian frontier, and you didn't have to do anything to any roads. The Germans must have felt very obliged to us. But I often wonder, they would have their aircraft out. I often wonder what the thought about it was all about, you know.
How did this affect your training, if you were digging and you obviously couldn't be training?
No, well, we didn't do it every day. You know, people took their turn for doing it. And we were just... But the training, again, consists mainly of marching and so on, you know, and a little bit of bayonet drill, very desultory sort of bayonet drill. Kind of the old-fashioned... We had a SMLE and the old-fashioned 18-inch bayonet, you know. And we used to practice poking it into sacks and that sort of thing. And it was...
And you weren't involved in the motorised roads so much?
I think once, it comes back to my memory, we did have a run round in the trucks and jumping off at a crossroad or something like that, you know. See, that was one of the things which didn't strike me at the time, but to debus trucks at a crossroad, which is on a map, perfect artillery, that's what we were doing. There's a certain degree of madness, I suppose, isn't it?
Did you not feel that between digging ditches, doing some infantry training in effect, and motorised training, that you were really not doing a great deal on any particular aspect? I'm thinking particularly in terms of the fact that later on when you had to do the long marches, were you fit enough? And you were
we were fit enough. But the thing that, because a lot of this is hindsight, you know, Harry, but the thing is that if a German soldier walked through our village, I probably wouldn't have recognised him. I'd have thought he was a member of the French army or something, you know. We knew roughly that the Germans wore grey-green uniform and that they had the different shaped helmets, but we didn't see anything very much, you know. There was a lot of singing of that unfortunate song, "We're going to hang out the washing on the Siegfried Line," you know, which later became an ironic sort of tune for the German radio, but there was very little. We once went on to a concert in Lille, where there was some. It can't have been a very high quality because I don't remember who the stars were, but I know there were stars of the English stage or the British stage, but I don't remember who they were. And inevitably they would finish up singing "They'll Always Be in England" and things like that, you know. But
and you hadn't had any opportunity at all to work with any other arm of the service?
No, not at all. As I say, we'd had the motorised or motorcyclised Northumberland Fusiliers on one occasion, but in the main, I don't know what we were acting like, you know.
Had you opportunities to fire on ranges anywhere?
No, we did once when we were at Amiens. But after that, no.
And was this the last place you were in before going into Belgium? Was this your
family? No. We subsequently went into a Faubourg of Lille, Faubourg des Postes.
But what time would this be?
This would be, it must have been April, you know, around about that time. And there again, we were in an urban area, sleeping in sort of empty houses and so on. And big city, the opportunities for drinking were much more. I remember one of my functions was a sergeant in charge of the closing the pub, the estaminet down. I had six men, we all marked with pick helves, you know. And the pubs closed down at 9:30. We had a serious look after, you know, and I would go into the first one and say, slap on the counter and say, Madame, fini. That was the usual number of catcalls from the assembled troops, you know. And I'd go to the next one, and I'd come back. And a lot of them had gone about. There were still some people there, you know. And I said, right, out. I'd get some more sort of abuse, you see. I'd go again down there and see all that. And when I came back, there was still some hardcore there. Say, are you lads going? Get a lot of cheek and so on. Well, of course, one of the things we were taught is never put a man in a position where he might strike a sergeant, because he would come off badly in a court-martial. So that says I have to go out and call a couple of my strong-arm men, bustle them out. They were private soldiers and they could chuck them out, you see. And we used to go up and down. That was the extent of our military activities, I think, marching up and down with pick-helves. On one occasion, they were going there, there was one of our lads, a young, rather tough lad, a bit of a boxer, subsequently killed as a sergeant major, I think, in Sicily with the 9th Battalion, although I wasn't there at the time. And there was this Frenchman, big, tall Frenchman. First time I'd really spoken to any members of our allies. And he said, hey, Tommy, you box. And I said, allez. Come on, you box. I remember this lad of ours from Chopper saying, Sarge Levitt, let's have a go at him. And I said, no, we're not supposed to. I'm going, allez, by the box. He still came up and had box. So I had to finish. I said to this lad, right, put your pick out down here and take your coat off. And I explained to this Frenchman and his followers, circle, nobody else must fight, only that friend. In this block of ours, bounced him once, he hit this Frenchman so hard. Knocked him down several times, clattering on the cobbles and so on. And eventually a Frenchman got up and put his hand out and said, fini, bon box. Anglais, and all the rest of them went away in quite good nature, you know. That was the only.
Were you getting any kind of thoughts or impressions of what the French army were like at this stage?
Well, they all seemed so sloppy, those that I did see, you know. Baggy sort of unkempt clothes and hands in their pockets, necks open sometime, you know. And they seemed to be so. Cigarette dripping from their mouth, you know. Typical sort of caricature. And they were really French soldiers. And we think, good God, you know. Whereas we were still had to be smart and walk around in a soldier-like fashion. You know, if you saw blood, take your hands out of your pocket. Or we, more vulgar, we'd say, take your bloody gloves off, boy. Because they put their hands in the pocket, you know, and make them march around and do the job right. And these French looked at hanging around in their staminets with their coats open and so on. Some of them even had their coats pinned back in the old-fashioned style of the 1418 war, you know. And not very impressed. Not quite sure whether one should be impressed, because we still had sort of memories, I certainly had, of the war when the French had put up such a good show down in places like that, you know. So I was thinking to myself, I hope they are better soldiers than they look. The typical arrogance of the British, who thought if you didn't look smart, you couldn't fight, you know. But there it is. So I hadn't formed a very high opinion.
Were the relationships good still at this stage between French and British?
Yeah, you just sort of said, bonjour, and they said, or bon oui, and they said, bon oui. But there was no fraternisation like there was between Americans and British later on in the war, you know. It wasn't awful, but you could sit down and talk, but it was a. Because the other thing was, I think perhaps one was a bit unkind, because the French had horrible rates of pay. I mean, they got a free wine supply for the, bit, but that's something where we had a shilling, they had about a tuppence or something like that, you know. So they were pretty, not much communication. It was a dream time, you know. We must have been mad to send all those men across there and not do something about it. I don't know what we expected. And of course, we were in an innocent state when we thought, well, we're doing as we're told, and we've got our officers here, we know them all. They all come from Gateshead and Bladen and places like that, and all our lads, we know our... So, all's right with the world. Complete. When I look back now, I shudder. I could almost burst into tears.
Why was that?
Well, a lot of those lads, very shortly, were going to die, you know, and be taken prisoner. And also, we should have made a better show at Dunkirk, you know. It is.
You've been in France some 4 months or more. What was the situation regarding mail from home and parcels?
Very good.
Did they start quite early?
Yes, yes, we got the mail. There was no problem at all about the mail there. Later, theatres of war, it wasn't very good at all, but there it was first class.
And what about censorship?
Well, you had to get your letters signed by an officer, you know. You took them to the officer. And again, you got the officer who did his duty by reading right down. And one or two junior officers did what they shouldn't have said. Is this your girlfriend? Or is this... No, it's my sister. They shouldn't have asked things like that. They should have seen if there was anything military. And a lot of the lads used to put SOF somewhere, SIF somewhere in France, you know. It was the romantic thing there. But they always got them initialed by...
This was one of the things that officers were not supposed to do, was to ask where the letter was going to.
No. They were just... if it had to check whether it was contained any military information. And George Leslie Wood used to err on the other side. He'd sign my letter, give me it back while he was talking about something else, you know. I could have been sending news, but he was that sort of a gentleman, you know. He knew I wouldn't do anything like that, but he thought I wouldn't do anything like that. And we were not saying, we're in a good place now, the people are very good, you know, the grub's good. You know, the usual sort of, rather limited sort of thing, you know. And I don't think anybody really tried to... In our battalion, the ones that kept, nobody tried to sort of pass information of any sort. Some of the lads used to ask me, how do you spell these words? Sometimes used to ask me. You know, they couldn't see any French places they'd been, you know, but it was funny.
Had leave started? Had anyone gone on leave?
I'd never heard of any. Compassionate leave, one or two had gone on compassionate leave because of births or deaths at home and so on, but we never had any leave. In fact, sounds rather silly to say it, but we'd have thought, go on leave? Well, what do you want to go on leave for? We haven't done anything yet, you know.
Do I take it that even at this stage, with the German assault about to start, that training had not advanced very far from the...
Not advanced very far. We were still, as I say, probably Sir John Moore in 1801 would have thought we weren't a bad lot. But the fact that there were tanks and airplanes and so on didn't seem to matter very much. We knew there were tanks, but we had this boys anti-tank rifle. And everybody said, you don't fire that, it'll break your shoulder if you don't hold it properly. Very heavy to carry. I heard of people, not in our battalion, but I heard of people who, as soon as the retreat started, they threw the boys anti-tank rifle away because it was too heavy to carry. You know.
Had you any scares of the Germans starting the attack before it actually did start?
Well, I think once there was something like that start, because we all got in trucks with it and we all got up and then came back again, you know. And I rather think that it must have been a scare, or nothing was said about it, you know.
Had anyone suggested to you that there was parachutes about, or fifth columnists?
No. They used to... Generally, you can't trust these bloody French, you know. But I mean, that was normal because they were foreigners, you know. But no, the parachutists, didn't know anything about parachutes in those days, and airplanes. And we never, we never once had any enemy aircraft around at all. We got up to Lille, which isn't very, very far from them. But of course, the Germans then would have had to cross Belgium, which was a neutral country then. So there was nothing.
Do you recall what you were doing at the time of the 10th of May when the German attack started?
Now then. No, I think we were in Lille. And somebody said the balloon gone up, and we suddenly saw German planes dropping bombs in the town zone. And then I was called up by the sergeant major to go to Colonel Simpson, and Colonel Simpson said he was taking us and about 10 other people. There was a corporal from Bladen and one or two clerical types, you know, to two corps rear area, to get into a truck and buzz off. So we didn't even see our battalion move off, you know.
Why had there been a change made? Colonel Simpson was in command of the battalion. Why had he? Did you ever know why he was removed or what had happened?
No.
What his responsibilities were?
He was a kind heart sort of character, and he was a subaltern in the 1418 war. But I suspect he probably didn't have the makings of a leader in battle, you know. And that was it, you know.
So you feel that he was removed because of this?
I think it was probably because some of the other officers' lines lasted a bit longer, you know what I mean? I mean, for example, the 16th Durham's, their CO lasted until the first attack of the Germans in Tunisia and that sort of thing, you know. But there were always a few regular officers hanging behind, ready to leap in with promotion, you know.
And who took over from him?
That was Colonel Percy. He was a tall officer with a game leg, walked with a stick, very black moustache. And when he was bloody-minded, his moustache stood out like that when he was getting annoyed. We used to call him the Black Prince. he was really old regular. We did more training when we came back from France under Colonel Percy. We'd done all... Was there. But of course, I then left the battalion.
Yeah, so the battalion, in effect, went into Belgium.
And we moved.
And you went back to
Rio area. We started moving back. And we wandered all around. I couldn't tell you the sort of journey. One stage, we were mixed up with a whole lot of the French who were retreating. And then a whole lot of Belgians. Whacks and whacks of Belgians. This was way back in France. And I was talking to them, because they were just doing. And I've never known such... I talk to a bunch here, have a beer, and one of them say, be careful about talking to those Belgian soldiers over there. They're Vallon, French speaking. What a bit later they say, what's that? They're Flamand, they're Flemish. Those Flemish and Walloon or Vallon hated each other more than they did the Germans. Quite incredible. And they were retreating, and they were supposed, I said, what are you doing back in France? Oh, we're going to reassemble and then attack. But of course, it was all in a shambles.
What exactly was Colonel Simpson and the rest of you doing?
Well, we were supposed to go to two corps rear area and undertake some duties which were never detailed. But we were pulling round in half shot, and of course the British Army got up and then moved back. And we pulled right round, and we stopped for a day, and then two corps moved further back, or moved further east, as the case may be. We never caught them up to start doing anything.
So in effect, you were going around looking for two corps
headquarters? That's right.
We're never finding them?
Never really finding them. Or if we found them, they just moved on to so-and-so. Or we just got there and they moved back. They're complete and utter shambles. And we eventually stabilised at the small town of Berg, which, you know. And
How did you eat and sleep whilst this all is just going on now? Billeting and that kind of thing.
Well,
was it official or did you just find
somewhere? We just found somewhere and we just found some food, you know, and drew rations from the nearest place. I've had Belgian army rations, I had civilian rations. We were slipping all over the place and we got to Berg and then we got into a place there and we were getting rations. And then the first thing that happened was there was an awful lot of troops withdrawing through, you know, and Colonel Simpson said, I think this thing's folded up, Williams. Sergeant Major Armstrong was with us as well, the sergeant. And he said, I don't think we can do very much good. And he said, I think these two younger men, two 19-year-olds, who just joined, one of them was a lad from Chopwell, well, two lads from Chopwell. One takes me down, he lives at Concert now, he takes me down to the Denmark infantry thing, and kids. So we may as well send them back, get evacuated. And we send them off, he said, go and get your packet, and off they went, and be careful. And then he said, I think this is folding up. I said, and I said to Sergeant Major, not just Colonel Simpson, I said, Sergeant Major, we're supposed to be bloody soldiers. We can't just get off like this. He said, well, you can talk better than I can. That was his turn. So I went to the Colonel and I said, look, sir, is our job finished at Two Corps? And he said, yes, I'm afraid it is, William. I said, right, then I think there's something we could do here. I want to do something effective. He said, well, the town marshal's office is over there. Perhaps we could go and see him. So I said to Sergeant Major, you're the senior rank, do you want to go? He said, no, you go and explain. Actually, so I went in and there was an officer sitting there in Royal Artillery. I tossed him up a salute and I said, there's a Sergeant Major and myself a sergeant, I think it was 10 men of the Durham, a corporal and two corporals, sorry, and 8 men of the Durham Infantry. We've had a function related to Two Corps rear area, sir, that's finished. Anything we can do? He said, thank God, son. He said, this is fate, you know. He said, my name's Major Lambton. He said, my cousin is Lord Lambton. And he said, I'm jolly glad to see some infantry who seem to want to do something and know what they're bloody well doing. So he then gave us Dr. Block and I was handed over to an officer. And when one considered my future, he was an old last war officer of the Queen's Own Royal West Kent Regiment. And there was also an engineer officer. I put in charge under his command, and I was patrolling out, and I put sections out. So we flooded the canals, and then the Sergeant Major and I, the seawater came in, and obviously destroyed the organisms in the freshwater canals. And everything was beautifully phosphorescent. We threw a stone in, there were lovely ripples. And we, honestly, when we used to put our men out, we had to cross the canal and pull ourselves along on a rope like that. There was trace of flashing in all directions because the road sort of parted the water, the phosphorescent waters. Anyway, then I suddenly found myself sort of, he said, well, we had 111 men last night and 50 of the buggers have deserted, so see what you can do about it. So I'd get out and say, come on, you, in here. I was stopping people on the road. And on one occasion, I stopped practically a full company, the Pioneer Corps, complete with Colour Sergeant and Sergeant Major. I said, Sergeant Major, there's a job to be done here. Some slip trenches would fall in. And we were heavily stuckered. When I went along, the Sergeant Major, I hadn't talked to some of the sergeants. He said, we're bloody well getting out of here as soon as it gets dark. And I said to him, you should be bloody well ashamed of yourself. You're a Sergeant Major in the British Army. Country's in a danger. We're supposed to be bloody soldiers, and you're talking about getting out in the presence of all these men. And suddenly, the whole of them up with their rifles and said, we can bloody well shoot you if you talk like that. And I had my rifle in my hand, and whether I'd seen too many John Wayne pictures or something like that, but I didn't know John Wayne wasn't anybody then, but and I said, hoping I didn't look at the way I felt, I said, I've taken the first pressure. So the first one of shoots, he won't stop me firing this. Now, which one of you wants to die? And they put the rifles down. He said, well, you shouldn't talk to her. I said, well, stay in your bloody job and give an encouragement to these lads, because there were one or two wounded and so on. And then I went away and ran a little buttress. I would have been sick if my stomach hadn't been empty. And I was shaking before, completely shattered. That was the only time I betrayed a little bit of cruelty, because there was a tremendous Stuka raid and some artillery fire in the morning, people, and a lot of casualties. When I went up, this Sergeant Major was lying on a stretcher, face down, with a large chunk of his bottom shot off, groaning. And I went up, lifted his head up. I said, you said you were bloody well getting out, Sergeant Major? Good luck, I'm pleased to see you getting out. I thought after that, wasn't a very Christian thing to do, Williams, but that's what I thought about him.
How did the impression, seeing troops coming back and through you, that things were pretty bad, that the morale was...
The morale had disappeared. And to be quite frank...
These would be mainly, at this time, would be mainly what, second-line troops? Or?
They'd be mostly second-line troops and pioneer
corps.
One or two infantry, one or two. How they got there, I don't know. But the point is this, I should tell you, I thought long time before joining the Dunkirk Veterans Association, because I thought I might see some of these. And, you know, I'd get people in and put them in position. They couldn't be there all the time. And they'd be gone the next morning. They wouldn't stay and fight. The place was littered with rifles. I used to spend my time taking the bolt out of rifles and throwing them in a canal, you know, because a bolt was made for a particular rifle. I thought, well, Jerry won't use that one, you know. And then there was a broken down supply lorry, and I got some bags of tins of McConaughey and things like that. And I took them, and I was throwing them into the slit trenches where the blocks were still there. I took some out in the boat across the canal to these other lads, you know. And this captain in the Royal West Kent Regiment said, bit of a state, isn't it, sir? And I said, yes, sir. But I said, we can only do what we can do. He said, oh, yes, yes. And then there was this engineer officer. He was a regular officer there. He said, I want you to go with Sergeant Williams and his friend and do a patrol up to there, see how far the enemy are. Well, it was a bit difficult because the enemy might be somewhere, but there were a lot of flooded waters and so on. You know, it wasn't a very arduous patrol. Sometimes you drew a bit of fire, but that was all, a bit of trace of fire. You know, we didn't have any trace, Richard. And there was a bridge which was mined, ready to blow up. You had to step on the sleepers, get across it, and then down at the canal. And this officer, before we got the bridge, the engineer officer said, I'll just stay here, and you just go out and see how things are, and then come back and pick me up when you come back. And he did that on two nights. And the bloke started to say, what's he supposed to do? So I thought, well, I must report this. So the next, I don't know how long we were there. Quite a while, but the next night I said, could I have a word with you, sir? Yes, I said, look, both for myself and the men, we don't want this officer. He never does the patrols. And the men are talking. I said, it's bad for the morale of the men if they see an officer who's not doing his duty. I'd rather just do this myself. And he called this engineer officer and said, this sergeant tells me that you haven't been doing this patrols. That you've been waiting for him and then he's been giving you a report and you've been reporting to me. And this officer suddenly... one of these third programs, put his hand on his head. It's suicide, it's suicide. We're all going to die, and burst into tears. Bloody suicide, he said.
You didn't know his name, did you?
No. And this captain of the Royal Guard, shut up, you, using that word beginning with C. He said, bloody disgrace to the regular army. In front of it starting like this, you bloody son. He said, I'll have you bloody court-martialed if I get back to England. The bloke said, I don't care, I don't care. It's bloody suicide, I don't want to die. I never thought officers did things like that, you know. But the sequel of that was rather amusing, or macabre, actually, because the next night, it was just getting toward dusk, and the captain said, I can't do that. I've forgotten the name of this captain of the Royal West Kent Regiment. He said, I want you, Sergeant. He said, you. He had this other officer. They were in a bit of a... dugout, a sort of underneath the caisson of a sort of part of the canal, you know. He said, get your bloody kit. And he had his batman carrying his kit, you know. He said, come with me. We went to a little Y junction, you know, in the toilet. He said, now if I get back to England, you're going to be court martialed because you're a bloody disgrace to the British Army. Now get along that bloody road and get on your way out because you're a bloody disgrace. This bloke shot along this road. And I said, the officer looked at me, a bit of poor batman with him, you know. Never another word. And he said, well, that's that, Sergeant, said this captain, Royal Kent. I said, you do know, sir, that road's leading to the German line. This is the road to Dunkirk. I said, I know, Sergeant, I know.
Just before we leave Colonel Simpson, do you know what had happened to him when you left him in the...
No. There was one stage just before we left him when there was a convoy came through with wounded on it. some ambulances and some in trucks on top of kit. And we were standing there, and suddenly the Colonel Simpson said, "There's Campbell Slight." It was Major Campbell Slight. He used to be the D Company commander, you know? And he was lying wounded there. And I was standing respectfully behind Colonel Simpson while he was talking to him, asking how things had gone. And and Slight said, "Well, we seem to be on the way to Dunkirk now for evacuation of England. So when will you be coming out?" And Colonel Simpson then said, "Well, we've been told we've got to stay here and man this perimeter. So I don't suppose I'll be seeing you again." That was the first time I realized.
And was this at Berg?
This was at Berg, yes, yes.
And to the best knowledge that you have, you never knew what his duties were while you were
wandering. Never knew what it was, because... And then when I went into this, with the sergeant major, as we went into this position, I just became an ordinary sergeant again, because I meant to look after the feed, and I was doing patrols and trying to get... pulling men off the road. "Come on, you've got a bloody rifle, now get in there and stay there. I'll tell you what you know, that sort of thing." And rustling around all over the place. And I never saw Colonel Simpson after that anymore. But I think he got back to England all right, but I don't know when he went, you know what I mean?